So today we're going to look at designs in DNA, and we're going to talk about some biology. And it's going to be sort of an experiment, because in order to talk about designs in DNA, you have to really know something about DNA. And the problem with biology is that you need to know things. So the first part of the talk is just going to be about DNA and how it works and everything. So to begin with, I'd like to get a show of hands on people who have some experience in biology. Who has taken a high school class in biology? Oh, that's a lot. Okay, excellent. Okay, how many people have taken a college class in biology? Oh, that's a lot too. Okay, anybody take molecular biology or biochemistry? Okay, so we have a couple. So actually, molecular biology is pretty different. And you know, when I took biology in the 70s in college, you know, it was vastly different, and none of what I learned is actually useful anymore. So you have to keep up with the field. Okay, all of you biologists here, I want to know, what is the central dogma of biology? This is a term that was coined by Francis Crick, you know, the guy who discovered the structure of DNA. So what is the central dogma of biology? Who knows?
Life comes from other life.
Okay, it has to do something with how biology works. How does biology work?
Reductionistic?
No. Mark?
Information transfers.
Okay, that's sort of along the round that we're going to go. And so we have a cell.
Did you read that answer? We didn't hear what Mark said.
Yeah, what was the correct answer?
Mark said it has something to do with information and how it's transferred from the DNA, which is exactly what the central dogma is. So here we have our cell, and there are some it has some organelles in it. You know, one of them is the chloroplast in a plant, which is the organelle that captures sunlight and turns it into chemical energy and fixed carbon. And the other is a mitochondrion, which is the powerhouse of the cell. It provides all the high energy compounds that the cell needs to run all these reactions and stuff and make the machines go. But the part we're going to talk about is the stuff that's in the middle, in the nucleus. Okay, and that stuff is called DNA. And the central dogma is that the DNA gets transcribed to produce RNA. Okay, now the process is called transcription. Now you've probably heard of that term before. Who knows what transcription is in a general sense? What's a transcript? It's a copy. Okay, and actually a transcript, like if you have a transcript of like a video or something, you'll have the words will be in like written form instead of audio form. Okay, and so actually the transcription of DNA to RNA is essentially copying it. And why would you want to copy it? Why can't you just use the DNA directly? Well, actually it turns out that the RNA has to go outside the cell nucleus. Okay, so it goes out through the nuclear pores, and there's this other set of molecular machines called endoplasmic reticula. And this is like a factory. It's a cell factory, and its job is to take this RNA and process it through all the molecular machines, and it produces protein. Okay, so that's this central idea of all biology. So we have this information transfer from DNA to RNA to proteins, and proteins essentially run the show. Or at least that was the original idea. But now we know that some of the RNA also runs the show. But we're going to go with this for now. Okay, so in DNA, we actually have four different bases, two purine bases, and they look sort of the same. We have adenine and guanine, and two pyrimidine bases, and they sort of look the same, thymine and cytosine. So the DNA alphabet consists of four letters, okay? So it's not like English where you have 26, you only have four. It's easy, right? Okay, we have four letters. Okay, now the letters consist of a base. Okay, in this case it's an adenine base. And attached to the base is a sugar. In DNA it's deoxyribose, and it's linked through a glycosidic bond, which is a pretty strong kind of bond. And this is called a nucleoside. And in DNA, what happens is that these nucleosides are also attached to a phosphate group. Okay, and when it's attached to a phosphate group, it's called a nucleotide. So this is essentially the building block of DNA. It's this nucleotide, which consists of the base and a sugar and a phosphate. And they all get linked together, which we're going to see next. Okay, so here's our adenine, and it's bound through the sugars. Okay, so we can see the adenine is bound here to a cytosine, and it's through that phosphate bond. Okay, and then we have guanine, this is our third base, and thymine, this is our fourth base. And so here we have one strand of DNA, and those are the bases. The bases are there. The sugars are there, and the phosphate bonds are on the end. But DNA consists of a double helix. Okay, that means we have two strands. Now the interesting part is that we have thymine. Now it turns out that adenine always base pairs with thymine. So we have this hydrogen bond, so you'll end up with adenine binding to the thymine. The cytosine binds to guanine, and vice versa, and also thymine with the adenine. So here we have, you know, the two strands are joined by these hydrogen bonds, which are sort of a weaker kind of bond and allows the DNA to like open up for replication and stuff. So the interesting thing about this molecule is that the bonding on one strand goes from the 5-carbon to the 3-carbon, going in that direction. On the other strand, it goes in the opposite direction. So the two strands are called antiparallel. So the bases are complementary, and they're going in opposite directions. The neat thing about this is that if you take one of the strands and you make a copy of it, you're going to make a complementary base, so it's going to turn into the other strand. Okay, so whenever you copy two strands, you end up with the complement of each of the corresponding strand, and you end up with two exact copies that look like this. Now, you've all seen the models of DNA, and it's not a flat molecule. It's actually a helix that sort of has a goes in a
spiral.
Yes. Okay. Now, the really interesting part about this molecule is that the bases are on the inside. And this confused scientists a lot in the beginning, because they were thinking, okay, the bases are the things that are doing the action. They have to be sticking out so the cell can get to them. Okay, but that's not what happened. And Francis and Crick managed to figure out that the bases were actually on the inside of the helix, and the outside are the sugars, which provide the backbone. (Clears throat) Okay, now, things are not quite that simple. So we have our DNA, and the DNA is actually wrapped around some proteins called histones, and it forms what's called a nucleosome. And the nucleosomes are all sort of wrapped around also, and it becomes this very complicated structure that turns into this, a chromosome. So you've all heard of chromosomes, and in humans we have 23 pairs of chromosomes. Okay, so the DNA is sort of separated into these different chromosomes, and the chromosomes have a whole bunch of genes on them that do different things. And this is an electron micrograph of chromosome. They look sort of fuzzy, and they usually have a central part which is used for pulling them when the cell divides. But actually, you know, you probably learned that DNA was in chromosomes, but this is what a cell looks like most of the time. Anybody see the DNA here? Where's the DNA?
It's in the center.
It's in the center. Okay, how many chromosomes do you see?
23.
Okay. So this is actually a lymphocyte, which has a small cell, but it has a regular sized nucleus. So the nucleus looks really huge, and you can see the cytoplasm around the side is pretty small, and there's some little organelles in there and stuff. So this is our nucleus, which again is large. And if you notice, we have different colors. Okay, there's light parts and dark parts. And the light and dark parts actually mean something. The dark parts are called heterochromatin, and this is condensed DNA. So, you know, all of the cells have an entire complement of DNA. So all 3.2 billion base pairs are in every single cell. Does every cell do the same function?
No.
No. Okay, so why would you need all the DNA in all the cells? You don't really need it all, okay? And the stuff in the black is the stuff you don't need. Okay, the lighter part, the euchromatin, is actually the stuff that isn't condensed. It's actually sort of just floating out there, and that's the stuff that's going to get used by the cell to do the functions that it needs. Okay. Now, there's one more complicating thing, which isn't too complicated, but DNA and RNA are like almost exact copies, but not quite. So the first three base pairs, adenine, cytosine, guanine, those are common in both DNA and RNA. However, in RNA, the thymine is replaced with a uracil. Okay, so instead of having an ACGT, we have an ACGU. Okay, it's just sort of a little technical thing that you don't really need to know too much. But but essentially, this is the structure of the two molecules, the thymine versus the uracil. And the only difference is this methyl group on the thymine versus the uracil. And of course, RNA has the sugar ribose, and DNA has deoxyribose, as in deoxyribonucleic acid. So the sugars are slightly different and stuff. But it doesn't really affect the information content, which is essentially the same. So the other part that we need to know is how messenger RNA actually codes for protein. And it's really, really interesting. And the way it works is that we have our base pairs grouped in groups of three. Okay, and when three base pairs are grouped together, it's called a codon. And this is sort of an important thing because each codon codes for a specific amino acid. But it does this through this other molecule called transfer RNA. And the transfer RNA has a complementary set of of bases. Okay, so you can see the codon is on the RNA. On the tRNA, the transfer RNA, there's complementary bases. So the A is going with the U is going with the A, the G is going with the C. So those are complementary. So this transfer RNA will only bind to that sequence. Okay. Now at the other end, okay, so we have the binding there. At the other end of the transfer RNA molecule is the amino acid. Okay. So what this transfer RNA does is it transfers. So it transfers this amino acid to the protein that's being manufactured. So when the molecular machine comes up and it sees this codon here, this transfer RNA will bind to it and the molecular machine will transfer that amino acid onto the peptide chain.
Maybe you better point out the amino acid. There are only people
know. Oh, it's on the bottom.
And it's called
methionine.
Okay.
Everybody saw that, right? It sort of popped up and then it popped up. Okay. Now we can actually see this process happening, and I have this sort of neat electron micrograph, which I'm going to help to interpret for you. But what we have here, you can see all these dark things, the little dark blobs. Those are ribosomes. Those are the molecular machine that actually make the proteins. Okay. Now going down the center of this group is where the mRNA would be. You really couldn't see it in the electron micrograph because it's really, really small and skinny. But coming off of here, these things that are coming out, those are actually the protein strands. Okay, so this is actually protein translation in process. So the ribosomes are moving down the strand and the protein chains are coming off, and it's not just one ribosome. You can see there's a whole pile of them on this mRNA that are making all these proteins all at once. So that's the process. And next, we're going to go into the system by which the genetic code is translated. So who thinks that the genetic code of a chimpanzee is identical to the genetic code of a human being? Raise your hand.
It used to be. I don't know what
they're identical. Okay. Because genetic code does not mean genetic sequence. Okay. This is the genetic code. The genetic code tells you how the specific codons are translated into amino acids. So you can see we have we have our triplet code. Since there are three bases in each codon, and there are there are a possibility of 64 different ways that these three letters can be arranged.
Richard.
Yes.
Question. You had mentioned earlier that you thought, when you were in school back in the 70s, which is when I was in school too, that there's a lot of differences. You didn't really show any yet, did you? In the 70s, I learned it pretty much what you said.
Okay, well, this part is. But the part we're coming to is totally different.
Okay. Right. Is this more true for a banana or an apple as well?
This is true for everything. It used to be called the Universal Genetic Code, and it was thought that it applied to all living things. Now there are a few exceptions which are really, really interesting, but we're not going to cover those. So for our purposes, we're going to consider this to be universal. And yes, a chimpanzee uses the exact same genetic code as a human in order to translate. Now we have some. You'll notice some of them are in yellow. This one here, AUG. This is a start codon. So whenever the ribosome sees this code, it says, okay, I'm going to jump on here and I'm going to start. Okay? And it goes in one direction. Okay? So that's the start codon. Now, it also needs to know when to stop. So three of these codons actually don't code for an amino acid. They actually code for stop. So the ribosome gets to this code and it says, I'm done, and it goes off. Is there a difference? No, they're just three different ones, and why there are three, I don't know. Yes.
Take it if you go through each one of them.
Oh, you can't go through them. That's totally illegal. Yeah. No, there are a lot of proteins, and we're actually going to get to that question.
What is a protein?
Okay, so proteins are composed of amino acids, and here there are 20 amino acids. So we have 64 possible codons and 20 amino acids. So you can see, you know, some of these codons, you have multiple codons coding for just one amino acid. So you can see, like leucine, there are six different codons that will code for leucine. now, actually, this is actually sort of a design feature that we have this redundancy. So some of the characters code for the same things, but we're going to see how that really fits in with design in a little bit. Okay, so so here's our summary. We have our four letters, okay, an RNA, AU, GC, and the four letters form 64 three-letter words, which are the codons. But a lot of these words have identical meaning, which means they code for exactly the same amino acid. So we have a total of 20 unique words, which are the amino acids. And the amino acids are put together, you know, sequentially into a protein, and the protein has, the amino acids have different functions that allow them to fold differently, so you end up with this three-dimensional structure of a protein which can vary in quite subtle ways. Okay, so here we go. We're going to go back to our system here. So here we have our DNA, back to the central dogma. It gets transcribed to make RNA. The RNA goes into the cytoplasm, to the endoplasmic reticulum, and it gets translated into protein. So that's where we're going to go. And the design we're going to see is in the interaction of these three systems here.
Rich, maybe to speak to Mara's question, I don't know if this does or not, but to get to your earlier point, the proteins do essentially all the work in the body.
That was the original dogma was that proteins did everything. That's really not true anymore, because you know the proteins do a lot of the work, but there are also a lot of RNAs that do things. And we're not going to really go into that because that's sort of a topic onto its own. Okay, so this creature here is a single-celled protozoan called Trichomonas vaginalis, and it's just a single cell about the size of a blood cell, but it has 60,000 genes in its genome. Does anybody know how many genes humans have?
They keep changing it, but isn't it like 30,000, give or take 24,000 to 30,000?
Yeah, it's actually in that range. It's about 22,000. Okay, so how does this creature, which has, you know, has no brain, has no skeleton, has no heart, has no organs, how does it have 60,000 and we can get away with 22,000?
Good question. That's called
isn't that amazing?
Isn't it?
How could that be? Okay, well, we're going to find out why that is. Okay, so now we're going to go down to the level of genes. And I'm going to give you just a schematic of a typical gene. So a typical gene will have regions that are called exons. And the exons are the coding regions, okay? So these are the parts of the gene that specify the RNA that becomes the proteins. Now, in between the exons are sequences of DNA called introns. They're called introns because they're in between. So, isn't that lovely? Now, so this DNA here is going, and usually on the ends there's untranslated regions, which, you know, they serve a purpose, but not for us. Okay, so here's our pre-RNA. So essentially, this DNA here, this gene, it gets transcribed to form this pre-RNA. Now you notice the RNA, it has all the parts are here. You know, the untranslated regions, the exons, the introns, they're all there. Now what happens is that after the pre-RNA, the message is generated. And the message is generated by slicing out the introns. Okay? So that's sort of interesting, but the question is, why would God design a gene that has junk in the middle and you transcribe it and then you slice it out? Why would that be? Why would you want to do that? I'm going to tell you.
Because it instructs the process.
Actually, it's part of the design. And here we're going to find out here. So here we have another gene. This gene has five exons, okay? It turns out, so this is the pre-mRNA, which has the introns in it, the exons are there. When it gets spliced, you can end up with all five exons, or you can end up with only four exons. Okay? So what's going to happen here? Okay, when this gets translated, you're going to end up with protein A, and you're going to end up with protein B. Isn't that interesting? So here we have one gene, and it's producing two different proteins. Amazing.
Rich, was this called the gene expression? Was this the term they used for this?
Well, this is part of gene expression, but gene expression is sort of a general global term. This is alternate splicing. So we have these exons. You know, you're wondering, why do we have genes that are composed of pieces? Because you can put the pieces together. So there are actually a number of different ways in which the exons can be put together. Sometimes you just skip an exon. Sometimes you'll have an either-or exon, or you can have one at this end and one at that end. So there's all different ways of combining these exons to generate different proteins. And it turns out that on genes that have multiple exons, on average they have 5 to 6 splice variants of proteins. Okay? Isn't that fantastic? So essentially from our 22,000 genes, we end up with over 100,000 proteins. Pretty good design, right?
So okay. It doesn't do that. Is that what you're saying?
It probably doesn't. Probably doesn't have a lot of splicing and stuff, and it doesn't need to do that much either, because you know it's only one cell. It doesn't have to, you know, it has to make some cilia and different things. But okay, now this is our second evidence of design, and we're going to look at something that are called duons, and these are essentially overlapping regulatory and protein coding regions. And this concept, or actually, you know, this principle was not discovered until 3 months ago. Before 3 months ago, we didn't even know that these things existed, and there's a good reason for that, which we're going to get to. So here's our gene, and this is a gene that I'm working with called interferon gamma, and it's involved in the immune system. It does it sort of helps in immunity to infections, but it also can get dysregulated and cause bad things to happen, such as inflammatory bowel disease. And this gene has three exons, and we've seen this kind of structure before. Now, it also has a region called the promoter region. So, by the name, what do you think that sort of suggests? It promotes, right? Okay, so this is actually the part of the gene, you know, it doesn't code for protein, but it promotes what happens downstream. And if we look at this region, it has different sites on it. And the sites are sites that have a specific sequence, and the sequence will actually bind to what are called transcription factors. So you can see down at the bottom here, this list, the NF-kappa B, NFAT, AP1, those are all transcription factors. And a transcription factor, it does either of one of two things. It can either promote the expression of the gene, or it can turn off the expression of the gene. So we have all these transcription factors, and the initial idea was that the transcription factors are found in the promoter. Okay? Because that's where you would need them to be, right? Would they be anywhere else? Would we look for them anywhere else? No. Should we look for them anywhere else? Yes. Okay, so one group of investigators decided they were going to look at all the transcription binding factor sites in the entire human genome. Okay, and they did this by a sort of a little trick. There's an enzyme called DNase 1, and what it does is it chews up DNA. So it sees DNA and it slices it into base pairs. And, you know, it's a naturally occurring molecule, because sometimes you need to chew up DNA to recycle the components into new DNA. So, but they used it looking at, essentially, they looked at 81 different cell lines. Now, the reason why they took all these cell lines is because they wanted to make sure that they got all the different transcription factors that are active in different cells. Because as we said before, you know, a heart cell is doing something different from a kidney cell. So these cells have different functions, so different genes are going to be turned on or off depending on what function they have. So they took these 81 different cells, they added the DNase, and it turns out the DNase only works if the DNA is not bound to protein. So essentially, the transcription factors will bind to the DNA, and where they bind to the DNA, they will prevent the DNase from working. Okay, so the DNA is going to get chewed up except for the little pieces that are bound to transcription factors. So what they did is they took all the pieces that were left, and they sequenced them, and they mapped them to the entire human genome. And essentially, it looks something like this, where the ones that are really high are the ones that are chewed up, and the ones that are low aren't. And if you look at the transcription factor binding sites, you'll see that where the transcription factors are binding, the DNA isn't being chewed up. Okay, so they've mapped all of these regions, and did they find them only in the promoter sequences? No. Mark.
Do they look to those promoter things in the gene to, like, in the way you said they can shut down, they can add to, or, you know, corrupt?
Yes. You know, all of these functions that we're seeing, they can be dysregulated in cancer. So, you know, it can be very, very complicated. But we're not going to get into that because we're just doing general stuff here. Okay, so what they found is that you have these duon sequences, and a duon is essentially an area of DNA that codes not only for the transcription factor, but it also codes for protein. So they found these duons in protein coding exons. So what does that mean? That means that the duon code is overlapping. Okay. And they found this in 86% of the genes. 86% of all genes in the human genome express these duon sequences, even though we didn't even know they existed until 3 months ago.
Now, where were they again?
Is that amazing?
Say it again, Richard. Where did they find them?
Where did they find them? This is the human genome.
Yeah, I know. And then they were found in exons, did you say?
Yeah, they're found in exons.
Okay.
Okay, and it turns out that 14% of all the exon coding space is composed of a duon. Okay, so that's a large amount. You know, you might expect to see, you know, a little bit of it, but 14% of all the exons have these overlapping transcription factor binding sites within the sequence. Ross?
So duon means overlapping code.
And yes, it means dual code.
The concept of that, is that what is only 3 months old, is the word duon?
The word is, and the concept is, because before 3 months ago, we did not know that these transcription factor binding sites overlapped with the exon protein coding regions. That would be totally unexpected. The reason why we didn't know that they existed is because, according to evolution, they probably shouldn't exist. So nobody was looking for them, because why would they exist?
According to evolution, they should or should not?
They should not. Okay. Because I'll give you an example, and you'll see why it seems really, really unlikely. So that's essentially, in the human genome, there's over 12 million base pairs that are represented by these dual coding sequences. Okay, so I'm going to give you an example, and this is from the cahedron EGF LAG7 pass G type receptor 2, also known as CELSR2 gene. It's a very friendly gene. Okay, so here we have the DNA sequence. Okay, and so these are the base pairs. The little brackets show our codons, okay, so they're in groups of threes, and the codons will code for a certain protein sequence. Okay, so that's what we know, just, you know, translating the code into the protein. Now, it turns out that this particular code is also a binding sequence for this transcription factor called CTCF. Okay, this is a ubiquitous transcription factor that's involved in a lot of the genome. But as you can see, the sequence of the binding sequence is virtually identical to the sequence, the coding sequence in the DNA. Okay, and this is actually not an accident. So if you look here, we have two arginines in this sequence. But if you look at the DNA sequence of the two arginines, they're vastly different. One is coded by an AGG, and the other is coded by a CGC. And the reason for that is so that this group will actually line up with this transcription factor binding sequence. So the coding is being specifically designed to work on both the gene, the protein, and also this binding sequence that controls the promoter or controls the gene expression. Okay, so this is one reason why the genetic code is redundant, because in order to get this lower sequence, we have to use a different sequence to generate the amino acids that we need. Did everybody get that, or is that sort of out there? Okay.
It's very clever.
Okay. It is very clever. Yes.
Very clever. Double code.
It almost sounds like it's designed, doesn't it? Okay. So this is actually, I really like this graph because, you know, if you're thinking about designing some, if you were to design some kind of double code sequence, where would you want to put, where would you want to put the transcription factor binding site? In the first exon or in the last exon? You would want to put it in the first. And what do we find? It's in the first. And it's a huge amount. Almost, you know, most of them, almost all of them are in the first exon. Exactly what you would expect if these binding sites were actually controlling transcription. Amazing, huh? Okay. It's going to get better, believe it or not. Okay. Our next section is going to look at dual coding genes. Okay. And this research is actually a little bit older than the other, but it basically started in the mid 2000s that we were finding these dual coding genes. And essentially, when you have a sequence of DNA, you have what is called a reading frame. Okay, so here we have our reading frame, and you can see we have in groups of three going down the line, and it codes for this set of amino acids. Now, in theory, DNA actually has six potential reading frames. Okay, so that's our first one. Now, if we move the reading frame to the right by one base, we end up with this protein sequence on top. Is it the same as this one below it?
No.
No, it's totally different. Totally. Okay, so let's move it again. And there's another sequence. Totally different. Okay. Now, so this is only on one strand. Okay, DNA is double-stranded, right? Okay, so this is our complementary strand. Okay, so the G binds to C, T to A, G to C, all that stuff. Okay, so we have a complementary strand. Now, the interesting thing is, you know, the first strand is read left to right. The second strand is read right to left. Okay, so there we go. Now we have another sequence. It's totally different too. We have four of them. Okay, here's number five. It's totally different from all the other four. And number six. They're all totally different. Is that amazing? You know, if somebody were really smart, they could probably design these so that you can get two sequences that actually do two different things. Could evolution do that?
You don't get six proteins out of each.
No, you're not going to get that. I'm not even sure God could do that, but but he can do two. I know that much. Okay, so the interesting part of this is you know, in one of these frames, we have an ATG which is coding for methionine. So in this frame here, we're getting a new start sequence. Okay, so there's a new start right there. Now in the one below it, we put in a stop. Okay, so if we had some kind of mutation that did this, what would happen to the protein?
You'd end up with a peptide
that would be short
off and it might get chewed up or.
Yeah, it would be okay. So frame shift mutations that change the reading frame of a gene are almost always bad. Okay, because what they're going to do is they're going to change the protein coding sequence from one to another. And it's going to be totally different, and I trust me, they are not going to be the same functional kind of protein. Okay. So those are our reading frames. And reading frames are really involved in this whole idea of dual coding genes. And I'm going to give you a quote here from one of the scientists who is working on this, and he's an evolutionist, so he needs to put it in terms that are a little more acceptable. But he says, coding of multiple proteins by overlapping reading frames is not a feature one would associate with eukaryotic genes. Indeed, codependency between codons of overlapping protein coding regions imposes a unique set of evolutionary constraints, as in, like, probably not going to happen, making it a costly arrangement. Yet in cases of tightly co-expressed interacting proteins, dual coding may be advantageous. Okay, here we show that although dual coding is nearly impossible by chance, a number of human transcripts contain overlapping coding regions. Okay, so that's sort of an admission, but we're still going down the evolutionary road, but we realize that it's problematic. Okay, so there still is this evolutionary assumption. And the assumption is that if you have a true dual coding gene, it's going to be conserved among related species. Okay. So mostly in the studies that are looking for these genes, they're specifically looking for these dual coding genes that they can find in, you know, in mice and humans and stuff like this. But it turns out that assumption is probably leading to a gross underestimate of the actual number of these genes. And in one study, it found that 9% of human genes and 7% of mouse genes were actually dual coding. They also found that less than 30% of those dual coding genes were actually shared between mice and humans. So the studies that are looking at the conserved dual coding are actually missing. They're going to be missing some of them. And the really interesting part is that 90% of these dual coding genes are on opposite strands. Okay? So one's being translated this way, one's being translated this way. And how does that happen? Okay, a study from 2013 found that there are 1,259 alternative proteins based on this dual coding. Yes, Ross?
Richard, have we found any examples of a triple code?
You know, I think that some might exist, but I'm not certain. So, okay. So I want to give you a sort of an analogy as to what this actually means. So look at these sentences and tell me if there's anything unusual you notice about them. Okay, so you can read the sentences in both directions. Okay? These are palindromes. But okay. But trust me, somebody actually designed these sentences. These are not sentences that you would normally speak. You could not go and speak in a sentence that would go both directions. That would just not be very easy to do. So essentially what we have here in dual coding genes that are reading in opposite directions, we have a system. It would be like writing a novel in one direction that you could read from front to back, and you could also read it from back to front, and you would get two different stories that exactly made sense. How likely is that to happen? That will be your assignment for next week. Bring that in. Okay. So now we're going to look at some specific examples to see how this works. Okay. This is an elongation initiation factor 6, and it codes for a protein that sort of helps in translation, and it's also involved in in the cytoskeletal component of cells. So this is our frame number 1, and you can see we have these exons here, and the number is the length of the codons that are coded here. And this is our frame number two. And it turns out that both of these frames begin at the same location. But the one on the bottom, the second one, is okay. They actually end at different places. So the first one codes for 108 amino acids. The second one is over double that. But the interesting part of the second one is that, you know, here we have this exon here is actually reading through the intron. Okay, so
it's not an intron, really.
Well, it's not in this case, but it's sort of an intron, but it's not, I guess. I don't know. But occasionally you will get this reading through. But the reading through on the intron actually creates a frame shift, and you can see on the arrows, that's the part that is actually overlapping. And that code is shown here, and there's our sequence. And this is from our frame number one. This is the amino acid sequence that we'll get, and the frame shift moves it over one, so we end up with getting different amino acids. And as you can see, they're vastly different. So here we have this protein that is made, you know, we're getting two different proteins, and the code is overlapping and it's frame shifted. And both proteins work. Who would have known?
The evolutionist
Okay. Now here's our second example. And the second example is actually it consists of three different proteins that are generated. The top two, we have a long sequence, and then we have a short sequence. Those are alternate transcripts. So that was our first evidence of design. So here we have our first evidence of design. And we also have this intermediate, which, as you can see, it doesn't start at the same location. It's actually shifted over. So it's running in an alternate reading frame. And so we get, these are the amino acid sequences we get. And of course, they all start with methionine, but other than that, they're pretty much different.
This is on a single strand of DNA, so this would be a triple.
It's sort of a triple.
Okay.
Yeah.
At the beginning,
you're gonna get three
amino acids. There's four.
Yeah.
You'd have a triple coding.
Yes, you do have triple coding here. And so then, but after this point, you know, exons two has the same. So they all get spliced together, and you end up with these three different proteins. And this is actually a gel, which shows the ladders on the left side, and the top band at the very top is the long one, and the next one down is the intermediate, and the short one is at the bottom. So you can see that all three of these forms are expressed in different kinds of organs. So but they're expressed in different levels. So, you know, this is definitely a form of design. So that we have these three different proteins from one gene, and they're expressed in different levels in different organs.
What's the significance of the difference in brightness in each of the segments?
Okay, so the brightness in the bands? Okay. More brightness means more stuff.
More genes.
Yes.
More
protein. So some of them, you know, if you're on this side of the room, you're basically not seeing this band, but they do exist on the other side of the room.
What's the difference? Intermediate and long, what's the same?
Oh, no, they don't look the same. They're shifted by a small amount, but they're not that different in size. Okay, so this is gel electrophoresis. So this is 200 base pairs, and this is 50. So that's our ladder, which tells us how big they are. So the big ones are at the top, the little ones are at the bottom. Everybody get that? I sort of jumped into it without explaining what a gel is. But you know, we do them all the time.
So this is actually, you measure the protein here. So it's not really base pairs, it's amino acids.
Right. Okay. These are the peptides that are produced by this gene.
Yeah. Okay. Not the gene.
So they, you know, not only did the study look at the genes, but they also looked at the gene products to show, you know, not only do we have this design, but we have the design different in different organs. That's the amazing part. You know, it's controllable. Okay, so we're basically done. So what we've learned here is we've learned that there are at least three independent examples of design in DNA. There are actually many, many more. But it could take like 10 hours to go through all of them. So the first one is alternate splicing. That's where you have a gene with multiple exons, and some of the exons get used in some proteins and some get used in other proteins. So you make multiple proteins from one gene. Okay. We have the duons. The duons, you will remember, those are the coding regions that actually code for not only protein, but they also code for transcription factor binding, which controls the protein. So the control is within the protein coding region itself. You know, it codes for itself. It's just sort of amazing. And then finally, I showed you the dual coding genes, where you often have multiple transcripts that are frame shifted. So you end up with genes that are totally different based upon a total different sequence of the reading frame from the mRNA. And that's it. Do we have any questions? Did everybody get that?
Well, thanks for giving us the dumbed down version.
No, it really wasn't that dumbed down. So if you got it, that's really, really good. Yes.
I'm still not clear on how the transcription binding sites work. Can you explain that?
Okay.
Would that be the start and stop?
No, actually, transcription factor binding sites are unrelated to the sequence that gets coded. A transcription factor is just a protein that binds to DNA that controls whether or not the protein gets transcribed to RNA.
Okay, so it would be a start and a stop then.
It's usually not quite that specific. It's usually like turn it up, turn it down. You know, it's usually not start and stop, but sometimes it is.
Okay.
But it depends on the transcription factor. And there are multiple transcription factors, you know, in the genes. You know, some of these duons will have several transcription factors in the same gene, and they're dual coded.
So the protein would bind to the DNA, not the RNA, but to
yes.
the DNA when it's and it regulates
whether or not the DNA is turned into RNA. Okay,
so transcription.
The transcription. It can turn it on, or it can turn it off.
Okay.
So you know we expected to find those regions in the promoter, because it was originally thought that the promoter controls the entire expression of the gene. Not true. You know, there a lot of these duons are in the first exon. So if you have a transcription factor binding site in the first exon, it can also control whether or not the gene is transcribed to RNA.
Okay. And the protein would only bind to the DNA when the DNA is separated or opened for transcription.
Yes.
Okay, so it's come in then and regulate.
Rich, we know that the origin life scenario is obviously very complex and like nearly impossible. It sounds like this obviously would take impossibility and like squared. Is that correct? Obviously, because the DNA, it just got it, more complex.
Right.
The odds by chance, just like.
Right. Yeah. And you know,
infinity square.
If we had learned all of this at once, I don't think there would be any evolutionists. But the system just keeps getting more and more complicated. And it's like, you know, well, they can do this, and they can do this, and it just keeps adding up. But if you look at the entire picture, you find that you know, it's implausible. You know, it was designed. You know, it just blows my mind that people can go through this, because, you know, they said, oh, well, this happened, and now some of this happens. And it becomes more and more incredulous, but since it's incremental, you know, you just don't really notice that it's really designed.
Well, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Rich.
If I were to meet up with some sort of science biologist and I wanted to evangelize him, I would say, and he believes in evolution, I would say, look at the duocodes or the duons.
Duons.
I could say, look at duons and then tell me about it.
Dual coding genes.
You could
ask him about those. You would.
I can't talk out loud and then lead him to your website.
Yes.
GodandScience.org if you want even more simpler explanation.
So you look at them and tell me if there's evolution. That's what I say. Good.
Okay.
Last question.
Wouldn't an evolutionist say that this stuff, even though it, like they always do, you know, that it looks designed, but that's because the ones that couldn't do all these things died out. How do you answer something like that?
Okay, but the issue with this kind of coding is when you have dual coding regions, you have a big problem in terms of evolution, because you're not selecting for just one sequence. You're selecting for two sequences. So if you have a mutation that affects one gene, maybe it helps that gene. But if it destroys the other gene, then you have nothing. So you have to have two simultaneous mutations that are both good, you know, for the one gene and good for the other gene. And most genes are either neutral or deleterious. So the chances of getting two really good ones on overlapping sequences are really, really small.
Which is why we see mutations drive things extinct and not create new things. And that's just the bottom line of what
we
see.
Things, I mean, even the idea of fine-tuning and all that stuff, there's so many factors that are, the chances against it are so
great. Right. Yep,
still,
we've seen that.
They say, because the old ones died out, I'm saying, but
yeah.
How do you make that jump? How do you get that across?
Now that goes with your worldview, obviously, and
probably.
You know, people have selective hearing. All right, we have a few announcements before we are dismissed. Once again, in the bulletin is all the Holy Week events are there for Month Thursday, Good Friday, and Easter. There's going to be a sunrise service in Bailey Canyon, and then again there'll be no class on Easter Sunday morning, and more than that, obviously the campus here will be completely shut down as we'll be worshiping down the street at Pasadena High School. Thank you to those that helped with the rummage sale. It was very successful, so if you helped purchase or donate your time, thank you. That was very successful. There's other things in here for children's ministry and women's ministry that you'd want to take a look at that I'm not going to highlight. Hugh's new book is out, and it is already sold out from our book table this week, but Colleen, we will have some more next week, correct? So Hugh's brand new book, Navigating Genesis, is out and selling very well, and so if you're interested in that, how much is it, Colleen?
$10.
$10, that's, you get a discount. You buy it here, obviously it's less money than if you buy it on the website. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, Liz's price is $20, so you get half price by coming to the class here, which is great, and no tax, obviously, or tax included. We pay tax, but it's included. The European model, yes.
Speaking of buying things, the Jamie's spell here, that thing, Unlocking the Mysteries of Life by Elstra.
Right.
I learned so much that I could even follow this.
That is a good follow-up. If you really want to get more information, Rich's PowerPoint is great. I've seen showing that. But if you're really interested on how complex life is the Unlocking the Mysteries of Life DVD here is very good because it goes through all the animation, which helps you understand the complexity. I mean, the cell is really a factory. As Hughes used that, Rich used that word a couple times, a factory, and it really is a factory. And as you said, the cell keeps getting more and more complex as far as what you see. The last thing I want to highlight, we're actually going to bring up. Ross Hogan to talk about. He's going to talk about one of these things. How many of you have ever been to a Messianic Passover Seder? Quite a few of you. If you have not been, I highly recommend it. Ross is going to come up and talk about this one here that's happening on the 15th. And if you can't go on the 15th, go to the Jews for Jesus website, and they hold some ones. There's other Messianic congregations here to really appreciate the Last Supper and to understand Last Supper, even to really deeply understand communion in a biblical sense. Obviously, a Messianic Passover Seder is a great place to learn about that. So, Ross, why don't you come up here and talk about this one here, and why don't you close us in prayer?
I've been to this one 3 times, and I keep going back. I'll go again. It's a little steep. It's $55 per person, but it's at the
Marriott. If you go, you'll find out why.
Yeah. It's at the Marriott Hotel in Woodland Hills. It's completely worth it. If you want to understand better our Jewish heritage a little bit better, it's really phenomenal. The guy who teaches that congregation is a Jew, and everything he teaches about is how Jesus fits into our Jewish heritage. You really see it from that standpoint. So he explains the entire Passover from Christian standpoint.
Excuse me, could I get a copy of that?
You could even go too if you wanted to.
But I'd like a copy.
All right. A couple of things real quick. The next Skeptics Forum is June 1st and 2nd if you don't have those dates written down. The next Casa de Dios trip, May 16 and 17. If you've never been, please, this is something to consider. Changes your life. If you don't appreciate your life, you will when you go down to Mexico and help build a house. I'm still doing my stair hike this coming Saturday, 6 days from now. If you want to go down to the Nazi camp in the Palisades, if you've never even heard about it, it's really there. Grab one of these. Yeah, it really is. But it's one of the weirdest places in L.A. It's completely safe, and it's free, and it's an amazing hike. So check it out. And I think that's it. Before I pray, I think we should give Rich another hand. That was an amazing presentation. How many weeks did you spend on that PowerPoint?
I always spend months.
Great job. Let's. Oh, yes. Sorry, Alan. Of those of you who are going to the hike or are interested, if anybody can give Alan a ride, please check with him after class. Who's... Yeah, because he needs a ride. La Cañada, the Pacific Palisades.
He lives in La Cañada.
Yes, and the hike's in the Palisades. Okay, let's pray. Lord, we ask that when we learn these kind of things, we realize that we don't really understand the purpose of it or the reason for it without, after we learn it, we go to you and say, thank you, what an amazing God that you planned this and built this and put this all together for us and for life. And it really helps me, it helps us to worship you. Thank you, Jesus, so much for this phenomenal thing that you gave us called life. We ask your blessing on each of us as we go our way this afternoon. In Jesus' name, amen.
Excuse me, can I just-